The content of the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. Now, it's time for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week, we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Call in between 12:30 and 1 p.m. on Sundays and present your case to our experts. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now, our host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is on, and we thank you for listening. Today, we're tackling grieving over a significant loss with guest expert, psychiatrist Dr. Harris Feinstein of Tampa, Florida. But first, this radio show and the free annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, now the largest in the country with over 1,000 women attending during each of our last two events, with a combined an excess of 7,500 hours of education, is supported by the not-for-profit Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission is to create an interactive, dynamic, community-based healthcare safety net, making you an expert on your personal medical needs. The result? Better partnering with your existing doctor, leading to more effective office visits, faster results, and a reduced economic burden of avoidable medical and emergency care. We save lives and protect families through the immediate impact of direct-with-the-expert health education. And before we continue on with today's show, as I mentioned last week, the Focus on Females Education Foundation is the subject of an interview in the Tampa Bay Wellness Magazine, which you could pick up at all CVS drugstores as well as Shapes Gyms in the Tampa Bay area. And this magazine, the Tampa Bay Wellness Magazine, does focus on health, fitness, medicine, nutrition, and lifestyle, and has an interview, 4 pages worth, and it's a very nice interview on the Education Foundation, and including why we do what we do and some of the examples and how we've really been able to transform lives of individuals and families through our direct with the expert education and the immediate impact that it grants. So look for it next time you go into your CVS drugstore. And today, once again, we are tackling grieving over a significant loss with Dr. Harris Feinstein. And Harris is a child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist who has been in private practice here in Tampa since 1988. He also provides psychiatric services to college students at the USF Counseling Center. He works with individuals, couples, and families. He has a special interest in psychotherapy and is triple boarded in pediatrics, adult psychiatry, and child and adolescent psychiatry. Dr. Feinstein has been an assistant director to the adolescent unit at the USF Psychiatry Center a co-director to the Adolescent Unit at the Northside Mental Health Center, and president of the medical staff at Bay Harbor, a residential psychiatric center for children and adolescents in Largo, Florida, in the 1990s. He has provided child, adolescent, and adult psychiatric services for 19 years to clients at the Northside Centers, a local community mental health center, also providing supervision to fellows in child psychiatry at the University of South Florida. He's also taught a seminar in psychotherapy for children and adolescents at the University Department of Psychiatry to child fellows this winter. So welcome once again. It's good to see you, Harris.
Oh, yeah. It's great to be back. Thank you.
And we encourage each and every one of you who is either personally going through a grieving period or perhaps you're not grieving, but you had a personal experience where you think you ought to be grieving, or you are interested in someone that is of importance to you, family, relative, neighbor, friend, a significant individual who perhaps is going through a grieving period over a significant loss and is interested in asking a question. This is really a golden opportunity to go ahead and pursue this information and get a greater understanding of what's happening here. And for that reason, our phone number here is 289-1860. That's 289-1860 in Hillsborough County, and outside of Hillsborough County is toll-free 877-969-8600. Once again, 877-969-8600. So, Harris, let's begin by with some definitions. Would you be able to share with us the difference between grieving, mourning, and bereavement?
Sure. And let me just digress a moment and say, when you asked me to come back, the reason that I had actually chosen this topic, you asked me what we thought might be helpful to the community, is because in my practice, one of the things that I've uncovered over the years is how many losses people experience as they go through life. It's just a process of the human experience. And at times, there certainly seem to be periods of sadness that get resurfaced when people are going through present stressors. And people do begin to talk with their therapist about the losses that they've gone through, the sadness, and they're really trying to understand themselves and try to figure out how to empower themselves and move on in life. In terms, I think the first term we might look at is the bereavement, which is actually the period of time, state of condition caused by the loss or death of a person of significance. I think prior to the program today, you asked me whether or not actually that would occur with other living things, and certainly in this day and age where people have a tendency to be isolated on occasion. Certainly families are moving. There's a lot of mobility in our society. People sometimes get very much more attached to their pets. And certainly we've seen a great deal of that also in terms of how much a loss of a loved one, an animal, someone that's been with you for a constant period of time can really affect one's functioning. So therefore, bereavement is really the state or condition caused by the loss through the death. Mourning probably has to do more with the select socialized period right after the loss. It's, in some societies, a much more prescribed period of time during the funeral process, during the burial period, when there's certainly a great deal of societal overlay that says, well, this is a period of time that everyone in the community also notices the loss as well. The grieving process, which needs to be differentiated, is a much more extended, widespread period of time. And I think people get confused because some people think that as soon as people stop the official mourning period, that the grieving period should be finished as well. And that's certainly not the case, that the grieving is a much more extended time frame in which people have to get back to relearning themselves. And a term that I picked up from one of the experts on grief, Attic, talks about relearning themselves and relearning the world.
So now, what I recall from years ago is that a grieving period normally can take a year or more, for that matter.
Oh, absolutely. I actually use probably the parameter of about 2 years for people to start to kind of recognize what they've experienced, what they've lost, and to assess whether there's been enough of a dynamic momentum in which the person is continuing to mentalize or digest and move on in the process. There needs to be movement. There's a back and forth sort of movement, but mainly what I look for with people in the grieving process over a 2-year period is to see whether they're getting stuck or not anywhere in terms of their function.
Mm-hmm. And I know in many cases religion plays a very strong supportive role in the grieving process.
Oh, I quite agree. And I always tell people that they need to have some sort of formula in which to, they have to invent it for themselves sometimes if they're not religious, but the religious practices certainly give people a structure and a form. There is so much confusion and chaos, particularly in the immediate loss, that people sort of feel like all the parameters have been lost. They don't feel like they have a sense of where the borders are, where the lines are. And I think the support of a religious understanding or a religious structure, something with significant psychological underpinnings, certainly help people to feel like they know how they can start to navigate. And I think all the various, the Christian religions, the Jewish religions, the Islamic religions, they all have certain ideas about how to go about that. Jews and Islamics, I think, try to get the person buried as quick as possible so that the mourning process can kick in and people can start to grieve. I find with people that have delayed the time of the burial that it takes a lot longer to get it started, but then that starts as well. Being involved in programs through the church or the synagogue, attending services, support groups, certainly give people a sense of belonging because there is a real isolative sort of experience that people have, like nobody can really understand what they're going through. And in a sense, that's very true. You know, I have a lot of people that come to me and talk to me about what comments others make to them about trying to move them along. I understand. And sometimes people don't really know what the other person has meant to them. And that's so important in terms of the grieving process, is to mm-hmm. be able to understand what the loss meant and what the person was like to that person before the death.
And for someone trying to be supportive, what have you found to be the best approach? Just to know, let the grieving individual know you're there for them?
I think that's completely accurate. I think that's really, really helpful. As human beings, we all have to go through painful things in life. You know, life is, Sigmund Freud used to talk about the normal misery of the human existence. And a loss and a death of a significant loved one is something we're all going to have to deal with sometime in our lifetime. But we don't have to go it alone. We have to do the process ourselves. And we have to be able to learn how to tolerate the pain and the sadness. But it's so much more comforting not to be isolated. Just the presence of someone else is so valuable.
Mm-hmm. And have you found the grieving experience to be any different in the setting of an expected death versus unexpected?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think we would all like to think that when we know that somebody's been very ill for a very long period of time and we're sort of expecting it, that we won't undergo the shock or the numbness that some of the experts describe as one of the first periods of the grieving process. And sometimes that occurs, but I think I've found over time it's so individual. Some people are still sort of shocked that when they finally know that someone is gone and they can't be replaced, their presence can't be experience or restored, it's still sometimes a little mm-hmm. overwhelming at times because you don't ever have this, mm-hmm. you never felt that sense of powerlessness and helplessness mm-hmm. that you can't actually bring that person back into mm-hmm. an experience.
So despite the fact that one may feel like they've prepared themselves, in actuality, a person may be surprised that in actuality they may not have you cannot prepare yourself in some cases.
Right, right. Well, you can know that you're going to go through it. Some people sort of are surprised that they still feel the depths of the loss.
And it's a finality at this point.
Yes, it's the finality, and being able to work through that, mm-hmm. and being able to accept it and to work through it.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break here and be right back for more. Please call with your questions. It is 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Outside of Hillsborough County, our number is toll-free, 877-969-8600. Be right back.
There is a bank that's been in your community since 1942. They don't have free checking, and you never have to sit in their drive-through line. And they don't have money. They have something that's far more valuable. It's the type of asset that comes from people, and it gets passed on to other people. What kind of bank, you say? A community blood bank. The Community Blood Bank. Florida Blood Services, a nonprofit healthcare provider that provides for the lives of thousands of patients in every Tampa Bay area hospital. Okay, so they're not a bank, but they depend on you if you're the giving type. And right now, there's an urgent need for O negative and O positive blood, for accident victims, for cancer patients, for life. So if you're the giving type and you have O negative or O positive blood, consider investing in Tampa Bay's Community Blood Bank, Florida Blood Services. For a donor center nearest you, call us at 1-800-68-BLOOD. That's 1-800-68-BLOOD. Or log on to fbsblood.org.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you. Your host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is ophthalmologist and eye surgeon Dr. Stephen L. Maskin. Dr. Maskin is the medical director of the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, the proud sponsor of today's show. At the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, Dr. Maskin specializes in solving difficult dry eye and cornea disorders with patients traveling from over 35 states and 5 continents for his evaluation. Dr. Maskin manages these dry eye disorders using innovative medical and surgical therapies, including the use of placenta-derived amniotic membrane, a new patent-pending natural eye lubricant to provide relief for dry eye sufferers, an exciting new procedure to unblock obstructed tear glands, and a topical cure for eye surface cancer. Dr. Maskin has been successfully managing difficult dry eye cases for over 20 years and is board-certified, fellowship-trained, and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and American Academy of Ophthalmology. He's been selected a best doctor in America every year from 2000 through 2009 and as an America's top ophthalmologist by Consumers Research Council of America. We hope the Focus on Females education programs, including this show, will help you and your family find the health care that works for you. Focus on Females believes in saving lives and protecting families. And please, visit drmaskin.com, and if you have not found relief for your painful red dry eyes, come in to see Dr. Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where comfortable eyes lead to restored lives.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsborough, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. I'm with Dr. Harris Feinstein, and the topic of today is grieving over a significant loss. And our number is 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Everywhere else, it's 877-969-8600. And please feel free to call in with your questions about this or a related topic. We encourage you to do so, and we welcome that. Harris, how does one actively grieve? Let's say someone has lost a significant parent, a child, within the last 24 hours. How does one actively begin the grieving process, and how does one actively grieve?
Yeah. Well, you set the timetable to 24 hours, where I think that probably is a very difficult time, because that's generally when we're in, have a numbness, we have a shock, we have a good sense of denial about what happens. Hopefully, you know, if we're in healthy enough shape and we have enough support, we're going to start to move from the shock and the disbelief over the course of a week or so into the actual acute mourning period. But I think your question is well worded, because you said, how do you actively grieve? Because it is a process, and there are things that we can do to help the process along. One of the things that we need to do is we need to continue to do the things that are healthy for the living. You know, one part of the process about the mourning period is that there's a part of us that is so joined with the dead, and we're trying to disconnect in a way, or we're fighting disconnecting, that, you know, people don't eat so well, they don't sleep so well, they get active, they get very irritated, they get very restless. And so anything that can kind of preserve that neurobiologic balance, if you will, of food to sustain us for the energy that's needed, and grieving is a very active, energy-demanding, draining period. Sleep is important. Eating is important, and not being so alone is important. You know, we were talking about the Jews with the Shiva period. It's a very active period in which they have lots of people visit for a whole week. You know, the community comes to them, and then after that week, then they get up and they go to the synagogue, and then they become a part of the grieving community in a more socially external place. So getting yourself around other people is also very important as well.
Isn't also a traditional way of sitting Shiva also to not be comfortable, not, in other words, not be in a comfortable chair? I remember years ago, my grandmother passed on, the family, her sons were sitting on boxes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In other words, to not be comfortable, and perhaps the purpose is to force one to think about the loss in the early stages of grieving.
Yeah, I'm not a spiritual expert in that, but I think probably there it does have something to do with the fact that one is going to be humble and acknowledge the loss to the community as well as to oneself and one relationship with the spiritual beliefs that one has. Certainly, I think there's enough of discomfort to go around anyway. I mean, people talk about an emptiness in their body. They feel like some people even experience symptoms that the dying or the dead have gone through in their illnesses, a sense of anger, frustration. One thing that people remark to me a lot about is the sighing process. And there's maybe even a physiologic etiology to that, in terms of our need for oxygen and breathing as we try to reestablish our sense of living.
So you mentioned about the importance of not being alone. I recall how, for example, an actor, Jimmy Stewart, when he lost his wife, things seemed to go downhill real quick. And I imagine that's not uncommon when one loses a spouse, for example. One may not, as you point out, may not eat properly. Maybe one doesn't take their medications. And if they are alone especially, then that becomes a particularly delicate and potentially troublesome period for that individual who is experiencing the loss for their own life.
Oh, absolutely. I think the loss of a spouse, particularly one's been married to for a very long period of time, is probably, in the hierarchy of things, probably the most traumatic things we do that are out of the usual that are in the normal human existence is the loss of a spouse over time. And what has to be cautious about also is, I know we're jumping back and forth between the acute mourning. Sometimes these things kind of creep up later on because the society or the community or people pay attention, you know, in the first week or the first month or 2 months. And then 6 months down the road when things seems to be going on and everybody seems to be getting back to their normal sort of function and schedule, people that are more isolated get forgotten about, and then they can deteriorate. Mm-hmm. So the idea about being able to stay in touch with people of this for a longer period of time is important as well.
Any other comments regarding how to, again, enter that actively grieving process or how to actively grieve? Obviously, maintaining one's own health is very important, as we've just discussed.
And getting back to pretty much the routine activities, I think, of life, whether it be going to the grocery store or whether it be taking care of the house. For those that have a job, I think that's also very, very important to get back eventually to work. The ones we worry about are people that are not able to take care of themselves physically and get back into a routine schedule. You know, you have to recognize that how upended the world is for someone that has been so significant in one's life for such a long period of time. I'm talking about like the example you used of the spouse, and how one has to re-engage and do these things, but also recognize that as one does these things, memories get triggered and the loss continues. So you continue the mourning process, that there were things that you did, maybe a favorite coffee house you went to, a restaurant you went to, an article in the newspaper about something that two of you shared in common, an interest. All these things continue to remind you that person is no longer there to share actively and alive what was cherished and enjoyed together.
And so these are, in a way, moments of that trigger these memories. And so I guess the challenge would be to move to a period to a point where these triggers, these memory triggers that one holds fondly and dearly, to move to a point where it's painful to one where it's a positive memory.
Right. And that's the long-term hope, to be able to continue to have the memory of the loved one. And it becomes more a memory of the mind than a memory of the mind and the heart, such that when you think about these things, they don't trigger negative feelings. They don't trigger pain. They don't trigger sadness. They don't trigger anger, frustration, but more a sense of an integrated, enjoyable part of one's life that had good parts and bad parts, and for the most part, hopefully somebody that was well connected to in a positive way, and sort of becomes weaved into your tapestry of your whole life. I tend to think about this as the integration of the person and the person's experience, not only in terms of what their life was before the death, but after the death, because hopefully the people continue to go and live and enjoy things in life. And these people that have been in our past, we still want to continue to be with them. We still want to be with them and remember things that they enjoyed doing, music they might have listened to, sports that they enjoyed playing. There's so many things that we continue to do to stay attached to or even engage in as a way to keep a healthy attachment to someone else, whether it be a cause someone might have like to have donated blood. And so what we end up doing is we find out we want to do the same sort of thing. But it becomes a much more helpful approach and attachment. It doesn't have the pain. In this way, it has actually a very optimistic, positive, powerful goodness about it that, you know, helps you to sustain the individual in a more positive position in your psyche.
Are there discrete stages that that people go through that are recognized?
Yes. There are. You know, Kubler-Ross was very instrumental in terms of death and dying, in terms of talking about her general principles about what people went through. Denial was her number one. You know, the idea that, no, this is not happening. I can't believe it. It's not happening to me, anger, being angry at the world, being angry at the person for dying, being angry at the doctors, being angry at the whole world that seems to be going on and enjoying life. Bargaining was her third stage, in which you said, well, if I do this, then maybe we can undo it. Maybe if I do that, then you can give me a few more hours, a few more days, a few more years with that person. And then, frankly, you get into the depressive state, in which I'm so sad. Why bother? Why bother getting out of bed? Why bother getting on with life? Why should I try to enjoy myself? Because the other person can enjoy it. The one that's gone has gone. And then there's a resolution that comes with finally acceptance and recognizing that that person will no longer be an active part of your life, in which there's a reciprocal relationship, and therefore one does have to give up that type of dynamic of the relationship. Now it becomes more of a relationship of one of the mind and the memory. Can have the internal dialogue, certainly, but there's no active, alive sort of process going on. Other people have talked about other types of stages. I mean, I think there's a lot of experts out there that have been very, very well respected. Bowlby, in terms of attachment, he used to talk about the first stage was the urge to recover the lost person, that you really would fight like hell to really have that person be reengaged with you and be alive. The disorganization and despair that people do feel when their world comes crumbling down, and then the reorganization.
Mm-hmm. And does everyone grieve in the same way?
No, I don't think so. I think that everybody has their own personality, and they also have their own relationship with the person and what that person meant to them. I think probably the most difficult relationship is usually when there's been an idealization in which that person could do no wrong, and hard to believe that that person could even die, beginning to see that the world is imperfect, that there's a humanness to people that we loved. I mean, I have patients all the time that could never believe. I had a patient in their 60s recently that lost someone in their 90s who could not believe that that parent could actually die. Mm-hmm. And it made it so difficult for them to realize that they were human and they had them on such a pedestal. So the relationship, the type of relationship that you have, certainly the more ambivalent of the relationship, usually it's a little higher developed, and you have to work through that as well.
We talked before the show about how some people can create a shrine to the loss. And of course, we talked before about thinking about in the movies, the movie Psycho, where Tony Perkins maintained the bedroom where his mother, of course, the character's mother, I guess, had passed on. Same way it had been, had been that way now for years and years and years, with the dust still on the bed covers and the clothes, the mom's clothes in the closet and so forth. I don't know if that would even happens in real life. Perhaps it does.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the death of a child is certainly probably the most difficult thing that we do, because nowadays, in this day and age, of course, with the way the medical science is, it's less frequent that children die before their parents. It's not the normal order of things, though. I think back in the 1900s, before the advent of antibiotics and all, and people had problems in childbirth, there were a lot more deaths of younger people in relationship to their parents. But nowadays, I think the death of a child is so much more hard and socially not as common. The idea of denial that things are going to change and the wish that everything would stay exactly the same. This is a way of coping in a way that you don't have to deal with any type of pain or any hard feelings, sad feelings, anxious feelings, feelings of the world is imperfect and things are out of order, a feeling of things coming apart. These are mechanisms that are in place up to a certain point. I mean, certainly you can see this in terms of the whole spectrum. I mean, there are people that will create a fund, a charitable organization, might be thought of in a way as a metaphor for a shrine in which someone's going to invest in cancer prevention, I was at the Miles for Moffitt run yesterday, a wonderful event, and you know, I saw people putting pictures of the last ones on their T-shirts, and they were giving donations in honor of those people. They're keeping them alive in their mind in a very positive social context. People that orchestrate parts of their house and things that they keep are such so that they don't have to deal with the change, which is so painful. And I think to move that along, in reference to our question before one of the breaks, was that the idea about being able to start to talk about the person and what the person meant to them, and to understand all the dimensions and the complexities of the relationship in a way that you not only hear about the facts of the relationship, but you get to hear about all the feelings.
Go ahead.
All
right. Let me ask you about children. How do you, obviously it depends upon the age of the child, but let's say you have a child between, say, 5 and 10, and say a parent is lost. How does the other parent best approach that?
That's a very good question. I think, first of all, for some people, having the child present can be a very good anchor for some of the parents that have lost the other spouse. In a way, it sort of gives them a bit of a structure in terms of what's good for the children or good for them. That's probably more long-term. In the acute situation, I get more questions about, should the children go to the funeral? How much involvement should they have in the process of the mourning? And I think years ago when I was a kid, the idea was, well, you know, you should protect the kids, you should leave the kids out of it. And I think the trouble there is that kids tend to fantasize and think about things that they're not actively involved with. And so being able to ask kids whether or not they want to be at the wake or whether they want to be at the funeral certainly is a very good question. Kids generally pick up, they're like tuning forks. I think we talked about this at another show. They pick up the emotional attunement of their parents, and so they resonate with the parents are going through. So if the parents are starting to think only not about themselves but about what's good for the child, the child starts to feel a little bit more empowered and anchored that there's going to be some sort of structure. Now, what I generally see is a lot of parents that are very, very surprised that they're not sad, the kids are not upset. If anything, maybe they're a little bit charged up. Sometimes they just want to play or not even acknowledge all of this. And in the latency age kids that you're talking about, generally kindergarten, I mean, that's on the tail end on the early years to the 10 years of age, they do tend to be more less abstract. And so need other ways to start to express their feelings. Some of them do it in play. Some of it do it with drawings, giving them things to color with so you get a sense of what they're about. But they don't grieve normally the same way that we do. Sometimes they get angry. Sometimes they will just get mischievous. And one just has to be attuned to see where they are in terms of their own function. Are they able to get back into school? Are they able to play with their classmates? Are they able to attend to their lessons and enjoy some things? These are sort of the dimensions that you look for in terms of measuring whether the children are able to tolerate the loss and yet go on.
And how about the preteen to the teenager age group?
Well, those are always a difficult one because, you know, the teenagers have a tendency to be rather egocentric. And very emotional anyway with the surging of the hormones. So sometimes we'll see very much exaggerated feelings expressed or else not wanting to talk about it at all and anywhere in between. But they certainly, depending upon the child, if they have an ability to talk, to be able to sit, to engage, and ask them what they're thinking and they're feeling. I think the biggest mistake we all make is thinking that we know how other people are thinking and feeling. And if we create a space, a relationship with them where it's open enough so it's receptive enough where they can just express themselves and they're feeling like they're respected, I think that works wonders to help people know that you're there for them, that they're not isolated, they're not alone. And their own individual unique experience is what you're interested in.
Okay, and again, I want to remind everybody listening that to call in with questions at 289-1860, 289-1860. That's in Hillsborough County. Everywhere else, 877-969-8600. We're going to take another quick break. Be right back with more on grieving over a significant loss with Dr. Harris Feinstein on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Be right back.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Call now in Hillsborough, 813-289-1860. Anywhere else, 877-969-8600. More in a few moments.
I am honored and I am humbled by this nomination.
President Obama has chosen his Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, to be his next Supreme Court nominee.
Not just for her intellect and record of achievement, but also for her temperament.
Some liberals are complaining that Kagan is not liberal enough.
Calling for a different level of scrutiny.
While some conservatives say there's not enough of a paper trail to know what she might do.
Because she hasn't been a judge, she doesn't have much of a paper trail.
Now, more than ever, getting to the bottom of the highest court in the land. Talk Radio 860. WGUL.
Your keyboard is not responding. Press any key to continue.
Not again.
What's the problem?
My laptop's stuck and displays pop-ups and fake antivirus.
Call Computech of Tampa Bay. They can help fix your problem starting at $39.95. Call 813-818-9075.
What's that number again?
Call Computech of Tampa Bay, 813-818-9075, or visit their website at soscomputertalk.com.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. Think of everything that's happening right now, from the effort to repeal Obamacare, the Tea Party movement, and the all-important elections in November. I keep up on all this and more at hotair.com. Every day, hotair.com shines a light on everything from the Democrats' plans to raise our taxes to choosing a new Supreme Court justice. And hotair.com is free. Log on to hotair.com and read what you've been missing. Hotair.com. From Obamacare to the November elections to choosing a new Supreme Court justice, keep up with it all by logging on to hotair.com. That's hotair.com.
Buying or selling a home or commercial property? Considering building or renovating? Maybe you just need an unbiased professional opinion. Britannia Building Consultants is the answer. BBC Home Inspections have saved clients time, money, and ensured their safety over 20,000 times. BBC aims at delivering exceptional value. There is simply no equal to partnering with BBC. Call our office at any time at 727-446-0110 or visit us on the web at BritanniaBCI.com.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you. Confused about dry eye? Not getting answers as to why your eyes are so red and painful and your blurry vision that gets a little better with a good blink? Now you can learn all about dry eye, the causes, treatments, and home remedies from the number one best-selling consumer book on dry eye problems, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome by Dr. Stephen Maskin. Published by Yale University Press, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome has been selected as a 2008 Best Book of the Year by the Association of American University Presses and a 2007 Best Consumer Health Book by Library Journal. Find answers for your dry eye. Go to your bookstore and pick up a copy of Reversing Dry Eye. You'll be glad you did.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, welcome back to Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Today we're covering grieving over a significant loss, and of course that could be anything of significance. It could be, you know, spouse, parent, child, pet, and for yourself or someone else that's who in turn is of significance to you, and you'd like to understand more about the grieving process. So we've discussed with our expert, Dr. Harris Feinstein, about grieving, and on the phone is Patrice from Kenneth City. Patrice, we'd like to welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. I'm Dr. Steve Maskin, and with me is Dr. Harris Feinstein.
Oh, hello, Patrice.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good.
Well, I was listening to you talking about children and the grieving process and how children will react and how they, whether or not they should attend the wake and things like that. And it reminded me of when my own father passed away. I was about 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was 36 years old, and she had five kids between the ages of 5 and 16 at home. So, as I remember, you know, when my father died, he died at home mm-hmm. in the morning before we were going to go to school. And I remember that, you know, it wasn't a shock to me. And I think it was not because I expected it, but because I remember seeing my mother almost just hysterical. I had never seen her like that before in my life. But even that didn't really impact me. And I think the reason why is because children are different in adults mm-hmm. psychologically in that they don't have their hard drives, if you will, are kind of wiped clean. They haven't lived their lives yet, and they don't have any kind of history or past trauma or drama to draw upon or that will actually amplify their loss. It's actually, as mm-hmm. time goes on, is when things start getting hard. For example, you know, my mother had to get three jobs. So in essence, when I lost my father, I lost my mother, too, because she was gone all the time.
That's interesting. And was your father's death expected?
No, it was unexpected.
Okay. And that's interesting. And also, I just, you know, make a point and turn it over to Harris. And I imagine as you go through life, too, from that point when you were 14, as you went through life and you saw how other people, other kids, other children, your peers perhaps, had relationships with their dads, at some point that may then come to bear on your own perspective of your loss or make it more profound perhaps.
I don't know. We were kind of, at that point, you know, you're kind of in survival mode. My mom was in survival mode and we were too. We weren't wealthy. And my father was a blue-collar worker. He was an artist. Mm-hmm. And another interesting aspect, though, was that, you know, I went with my mother to the funeral home. All of us kids did. And we were asked our opinion as far as the casket, you know, to pick it out. My father's suit. My father didn't own a suit. But they sold them there at the funeral home. So, you know, they showed us some suits, and I was glad that I had my input in picking out my father's suit, and I picked out my father's casket because I remember my father, you know, looking at this silver car. This is back in the early 70s when silver cars first came out. And I remember him saying to me that he really liked that color of car, so that's the kind of casket I picked out for him,
mm-hmm.
was a similar finish. And I picked out his headstone, too. And the engraving, and it made me feel better. Actually, it helped to be involved in that process for me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had been shut out, I think I would have been bitter
mm-hmm.
years later, you know. So my mom, I think, you know, she was just at a loss and was just glad that someone was making the decisions.
Mm.
And I didn't feel overburdened because I was too young to really realize I was being burdened, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually felt included, you know, and I felt a part of the process, which actually I think helped in the closure.
Mm-hmm. How old are you now, Patrice?
I'm over 50.
Okay. Harris, what do you
thoughts? Yeah, I think those are all very good points. I think, number one, you talked about the resiliency of childhood, too, that there does seem to be something that some kids are just gifted with from birth, that they have sort of a sense of being able to withstand lots of losses or problems or whatever. You mentioned about no history of past trauma, which was certainly very healthy. You know, you also brought out the point about, I was thinking about bigger families. You know, some families are bigger, and you were fortunate to be in a family of five children. And in a way, the siblings sort of take different roles with the other siblings. And so one has a sense of togetherness that one might not have if one was an only child.
Right.
And having a sense of involvement and togetherness, I hear that, you know, there was not a sense of people being alone and isolated. There was actually more of a togetherness and an ability to be able to be in charge of some things. And I think that was really, really very helpful to be included. The idea of remembering what your dad was about and what he knew and how you knew what he was about certainly also speaks to probably you knew a lot more about your dad in other areas as well. So there was also more to call on to start to be able to integrate into the mind and the memory and the closeness that, you know, makes for that long-term attachment after our parents go. So I think all of that kind of speaks to the positive. One other point is that you're right about children, that they're so different, because generally mostly children are egocentric. And while we know that some 14-year-olds are much more than others, most people also in the earlier kids want to know, you know, who's going to take care of me? That's their number one question. And when they start to get a sense that things are going to be taken care of for themselves, they're a little freer to be more themselves. Being 14 and being able to get out and participate and be an adult in training, sounds like it really strengthened you in the whole experience as well.
It's probably a little harder for me to relate. I don't have children of my own, never have had children. So the modern child is a lot different from when I grew up. You know, I started working when I was 11 years old with a paper route. And I did, you know, I lived in the Midwest, and at 14 we were allowed to work and do corn detasseling. And I don't know if children are allowed to work that young anymore. But I took, you know, I had responsibility at a young age. So,
which always sort of engenders and nurtures a sense of competency, which is what we want to do for children. And today, sometimes there's not as many opportunities. I mean, I remember when I was 6 years old and in first grade, I rode the city bus home. Nobody does that sort of thing anymore. And I was very competent to know how much money I had in my pocket and could, you know, pay the bus driver. And you had this ability at 11 to go out and have a paper route and work. You know, it makes yourself feel like you can depend on yourself, you have abilities, and you can weather circumstances, a sense of agency, mm-hmm. that you can have an effect on your world and make it better.
Unfortunately, we're at the end of the hour, but Patrice, I'd like to thank you for calling us and participating today and sharing your own personal experience. I'm sure our listeners are also better for it, and we want to thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Patrice.
Okay, and Harris, I'd like to thank you. I think we have another minute, Cedric. Okay, 20 seconds, maybe a wrap. What's your overall message?
That grief is something that we all have to go through. Understanding that it's an active process, we ought not to go it alone. We have to devise our own formula, and one of the things that can be very helpful is to talk about our experience, about our loved ones, to move them from our heart to our mind and integrate them in our whole experience.
Excellent. And next week on the Focus on Females Radio Health Care Clinic for the guys, we are doing benign prostatic hypertrophy. We are talking about the prostate next Sunday with Dr. Raul Ordorica from USF. That's benign prostatic hypertrophy, and we encourage each and every one of you to listen in. In the meantime, have a great week, and we'll see you next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Stay healthy. Bye-bye.